Station number 8939, Captain Ian Hamilton, reel 8.
I think you were telling me about when you used your Smith and Wesson 38 in anger.
I said it was a nice little revolver. It was, to hold and to feel and so on. And the only time I used it in anger was during Operation Goodwood. That was to the east of Caen, wasn't it? When some German prisoners were ambling slowly towards us, and I sort of waved it in their direction and said, "Raus!" and got them to move a bit faster. I wonder, is it a lethal weapon? I had occasion to shoot a calf in the Reichswald. As we got through the Reichswald, there was a burnt farm and some of the animals were very badly burned. There was a little calf wandering around, terribly burned, and we thought we'd better put it out of its misery. And I placed my revolver within a foot of its skull and fired, and quite honestly, I didn't notice anything happen. And so I tried again, and it was still standing. So I put it this time to its ear and fired again. And I think I fired four shots before it fell down. It must have had a jolly thick skull, I think. But it could have been a lethal weapon, because I remember on the practice ranges at Barnard Castle with the 61st Training Regiment, one of my duties was sometimes to take recruits on pistol practice. And on a couple of occasions, in spite of all the training beforehand, I've had somebody turn round, wave his pistol at me and say, "Please, sir, it won't fire." And I was jolly glad it didn't, because I know they're not supposed to do that sort of thing, but it takes a lot of strong, tight training and discipline to stop people doing that.
When you were sent to support the Highlanders across the Orne, who was it who sent you? From whom did you get your orders to go and
Well,
support them?
I myself from my squadron commander, but where they came from, I have no idea.
And was this supposed to be just for one specific operation, or were you supposed to stay on the other side of the Orne to act in general support?
I think from not my memory, if my memory serves me right, it was partly for moral support to the airborne, who by now been on the ground for several days, and partly to help out with a projected assault towards Saint-Honorine-la-Chardronnette. I think it was a combination of the two, because when I did finally take the tanks up just below the crest of a field. Incidentally, negotiating a field absolutely littered with bodies. I mean, you couldn't avoid running over them in front of the airborne's positions. As we passed through them, you could see how relieved they were to find some armour. Now, I believe, and I always have believed, that we were the first tanks to come, certainly to that part of their bridgehead. I've learnt since that there were some other tanks were sent over, but as far as I know, we were the only ones. I didn't see anybody else. We moved up to a hull down position with the in front of the airborne positions with the Highlanders. I say Highlanders because I'm pretty certain that's who it was.
Were they kilted?
No, they weren't kilted. We moved forward, they moved forward. We spotted a Mark IV enemy tank in the fields and fired at it. It took fire. We didn't see any crew get out. After the war, in fact, I found that tank still in position, and it had burnt out, of course. We were able to make use of some cover and did our proper drill of firing off a shot from one position and then reversing out of it and coming away again some yards to the side and that sort of thing. This was in a slight dip on the forward slope, and then the next thing we saw were the Highlanders running backward, back again. So we sort of moved further out into the open to try and stay put, to try and give them a bit of confidence. But we were told to withdraw back over the crest of the hill again. And I think they'd come up against something further on, which we didn't see, coming from the direction of the Colombel factory. And we spent some time that day and the next day doing odd shoots as a troop shoot on the Colombel factory, where there was some very tall tower, one tower in particular, which we tried to hit, but I don't know whether we hit it or not. We assumed there was some direct fire directive coming from there. At this point, we had some news from the squadron. The former second in command of the squadron, Dennis Aykroyd, came over in a scout car and gathered us round him and said, "You'll be sorry to know that we had an air raid last night on the field at Creslon, and several people were injured, and the squadron commander was injured, and my troop cheered." I had to repress any feelings myself, obviously, and the second in command told me that he'd had to take over command of the squadron, which we were very pleased to know.
Why was your squadron commander so unpopular?
He was just an unpopular person. one of the old school, more cavalry oriented, and he wasn't particularly liked.
What about the second in command? Was he better liked?
Super person. He was a civilian soldier, and he realised that we were there to do a job. We got to get on with it, and how best to do it with the minimum casualties, and most efficient way of doing the job. And everybody respected him. They'd have gone anywhere for Dennis. Often did.
I'd like to ask you a few questions about this action, this first action in that area. You say you passed through the airborne positions. What sort of positions had they got?
They were in slip trenches. In some cases they'd managed to improve on them. Really, that's all I can tell you. I can't tell you much else about it. We were in that position on that reverse slope for quite a time. It could have been as much as a week.
In support of them?
In support, yes.
Were you ahead of their front line or...?
Slightly, yes. I know it meant doing a recce from almost every day, sometimes several times a day, forward, and it meant crawling by the same dead German who, as the days went by under the sun, got bigger and bigger and bigger and more smelly.
This was a recce on foot then, up to the crest?
On my stomach, yes.
What sort of positions were the tanks in? Were they...
We were spread out in hull down positions in the field to start with, and then we moved nearer to the hedge and the trees in a position of readiness. In fact, actually, we stood to every morning before first light, and that's when we experienced the first of the German stonks, as they became known, when they would religiously send over artillery and mortar shells. And in fact, one mortar shell struck a carrier very close to my tank, which burnt and sent off ammunition and things in all directions. Also, there was one amusing and one rather frightening experience. My second sergeant needed to answer the calls of nature, and just as he had his trousers down, and a stray stonk came over, and he was literally caught with his trousers down. He wasn't injured. And while I and my troop sergeant were walking through our position one morning, there was a funny noise, a sound from behind us, from the sea, and we flattened ourselves on the ground, and there was a thump. And when we raised our heads, there was a glistening shell, hot and giving off heat rays, lying on the ground just a matter of yards from us. And it had obviously come from the sea somewhere. But fortunately, it didn't go off.
A naval drop short.
I think so, yes.
You say you're in a field. Was this a pasture or a ploughed field? Or?
No, it wasn't ploughed. It was grass, as far as I remember.
Over what sort of front were your troop dispersed for this support operation?
Ooh. How difficult to remember. I should think a matter of 100 yards or so, something like that. There was this sunken lane on the left coming up that went over the crest. It was a track, really. It wasn't a road. There were tall elm trees, which were a mixed blessing, because although they provided some air cover, they also caused any HE that was coming over to burst in the tops and shower things down with splinter. And then behind us, lower down, there was, as far as I remember, a sort of low stone walls farm, orchard, and then over to the right, there was quite a wood, and the airborne people were along the edge of that wood, and along the edge of the farm. That's as I remember it, anyway.
When you advanced in support of the Highlanders who'd gone through, were they advancing behind the tanks or in amongst you or in front of you?
I think initially they were in amongst. See, we were being used as gun tanks, of course. Our real job was to be called forward if they came across a minefield. They obviously didn't.
What sort of scale of attack were they putting in?
Well, I can't believe it was as much as a regimental one. I should think it was a one or two company attack, something like that.
Do you remember what sort of formation they were in with this advance?
Well, they were in open formation across the fields. As far as I remember, fairly well separated in the usual sort of V, that type of, they would be in, each section would be in a V formation, as far as I remember.
Just open arrowhead.
Open arrowhead, that's the word I was thinking for.
When you spotted the Mark IV and opened fire on it, did you stop to fire?
Yes. Yeah. We wanted to be sure.
Did you ever actually fire main armament on the move?
Not there. Oh, I think we did at Le Havre. Sure we did. We had this so-called gyroscopic control on the tank. I don't think we ever used it, really.
This was an auto-stabilizer, wasn't it?
Yes.
The gun.
Yes. But, no, we always... my troop. As far as I know, we all always did. From a stationary position.
What sort of range was it from the Mark IV?
As far as I remember, it was about 800 yards, something like that.
Over what sort of distance would you reckon to be able to spot an enemy tank and actually hit it?
Again, it depended on the terrain.
Given a fairly open...
In an open, rolling field situation, providing it wasn't dug in, you could spot one moving at a mile, perhaps. But I mean, that was way out of our range as far as any worthwhile fire was concerned. And while we were engaged in this movement, whether it was before we fired at this thing I think it was when we were moving up to this position in the first place, over the radio came a message. Tigers reported in Escoville, and my operator said, "Where's Escoville?" And I looked on the map. It was a couple of kilometres over to the left. We were not very happy, because we'd heard about tigers, but in fact we didn't see them.
Was this Mark IV just on its own?
No, I think there were some others. And incidentally, it wasn't an ordinary Mark IV. It was a disguised Mark IV. This is probably what had given rise to this Tiger thing, because it had these disguise plates mounted on fixtures to alter its silhouette. It was a long-barreled Mark IV, not a short-barreled.
When you shot at it, was it moving or still?
Well, we thought it was moving.
And was it a sort of troop volley?
No, it was just from my tank.
How many shots did you take to hit it?
I can't remember. I think we hit it probably with the first shot. We spotted smoke coming from it from straight away. I think we put about two or three shots in altogether, and it burnt.
Then I think you said you stopped to give support to the attack, and you got into concealed positions.
Well, we weren't particularly concealed, because we're on the forward slope of the hill, so we were pretty open.
But the infantry went forward on their own.
Yes.
Do you know how much further forward they went before they...
I couldn't have gone very far. Couldn't have gone very far. I cannot for the life of me visualise the ground over which they went, because we were slightly to the side.
When they moved back, did they seem to be in disorder and panic, or were they in reasonably...
Well, they were running back. As far as we could tell, they were in... bit of a panic. I think it was their first baptism, or very early one anyway.
Did you have any means of communicating with them? Were you able to speak to them to find out what had happened?
No, not at that point. Not until I got back to spoke to the company commander.
What did he have to say?
Can't remember.
Were there any enemy pursuing them?
Couldn't see any.
You were saying that later on you were involved in various shoots during that day at the tower at Colombelle.
Mm.
What sort of distance away was that?
Terribly difficult to say. It would have been several kilometres, several thousand yards.
What were you firing at it?
HE. Well, we needed to spot. We tried airburst to try and gauge the distance. But the ground was rather deceptive, I think, and it was very difficult to spot the full shot from where we were. And eventually the infantry said, for goodness sake, shut up, because you're drawing enemy fire on us. So we did.
You mentioned these daily stonks coming in, mainly mortar.
Mm-hmm.
What about artillery? Did you get a lot of that coming in on you?
I imagine so. I can't honestly remember. I know it was pretty thick and we kept our heads well down while it was happening.
Did you have slit trenches for that, or did you just get into the tank?
No. What we had devised from when we first got into Cresson was first of all to dig a wide trench, drive the put the tarpaulin in it, drive the tank over the top, and then seal up all the openings with whatever we could. We did more or less the same thing there. We dug quite a deep hole and put the tank over the top, and it was easier to get in and out of, because otherwise you had to climb right up on the turret to get inside the tank. One of my sergeant's crew, from D-Day onwards, would not get out of his tank. And for weeks, something like 3 weeks, I think, he just could not be persuaded to leave the tank at all. He was in a bit of a state. Strangely enough, the troop sergeant crew, as I told you, had fought in the desert with the 8th Army. And he had had this chap's brother in his tank there, and he had also had difficulties.
How did he eventually persuade him to come out of it?
I can't remember. But everybody took a hand in trying to persuade.
He sounds as though he was something of a psychological casualty.
Yes, I think he was. He finally disappeared on when the RAF bombed us at St. Aniel, Cremenil, on the attack. After the night attack, we were in reserve in an orchard. This is on the way to Falaise. And the RAF bombed us by mistake, bombed the Polish echelons and the field guns. And I don't know whether you want me to tell you about that now. Yes? We were in reserve, and we were in this orchard underneath the trees. And in the course of the afternoon, just as we were brewing up some tea, we saw a wave of Lancasters, Liberators, come over very low, a few hundred feet. You could see the pilots. We also saw the bomb doors open. And we knew that the next phase of the attack, which was this business across the Laison River that was holding everything up, that there was going to be a heavy bomber raid. And so we cheered them on their way. But then we saw the bombs leaving the bomb doors. And all we had time to do was to just drop everything and dive under our tanks. Well, because we were in reserve, we hadn't bothered to dig very much. I think we'd scraped a bit of a hole underneath. And this was largely anti-personnel stuff. And it dropped all round us. And it was pretty horrible. And as soon as that wave of bombers had moved away, we got out, and I said, right, there's another lot coming. You get inside and button up and switch on your radio. And don't move. Because one of the things we knew was that snooping round the outside of the bomberade were the typhoons to pick off anything that got out. So the thing was, we had to stay put, and we knew it was anti-personnel stuff, so we'd be all right inside. And we just about got inside, and the second lot came over. And I think that's the only time I've really prayed over the radio, because we knew that if the enemy knew about this, they'd be right through us like a dose of salts. And we sat out that raid, and as soon as that wave had gone over, I got out, and so did Sergeant Crewe, and we both shot. I got him to go round our five tanks, see if everyone was all right. I went over to try and find the squadron commander, see what was happening. He was just getting into his scout car. He couldn't get through on the radio to the brigade headquarters because we were under command. So he was going by scout car. Anyway, Jeff Crewe rejoined me, and just as we were passing one of our tanks, the third wave of bombers came over, and we dived underneath this tank, and they hadn't dug any hole at all. And there was shrapnel whizzing about underneath, and we were literally biting the dust and breathing it in. And when that was over, we got back, and I think there was even a fourth raid. I remember seeing the artillery spotter planes flying underneath these bombers, waggling their wings, firing out fairy lights, doing everything in their power to try and divert these blighters. Eventually, the fifth wave came over, didn't drop anything, and we saw it turn round. And we understood later that message had got through via army, through to London, to fight a bomber command, and then through. Apparently in the first wave, the only ground air link had been shattered. And after that, they took the precaution of having several ground air links. But we put out our signal smoke, we put out our, what do you call them, identification panels. Didn't make any difference, they just came on. That was pretty horrific. But the poor Poles suffered. Their B echelon was practically eliminated, and the gunners in their open gun pits also suffered very badly.
How long did it take